but rather to publicize it and to maintain the front that everything was okay. To one of his worried investors, William Rankin of the Niagara Falls Project, he wrote on April the 10th, "Doubt the light of the sun, doubt the brightness of the stars, but do not doubt the existence of the Nikola Tesla Company." Landing Morgan in the first instance had been a feather in his cap. Now the bon vivant decided to exploit the connection, and also brazenly rebel against a man who seemed bent on sinking his ship. In quintessential Teslaic fashion, he published a spectacular article simultaneously in Scientific American and Electrical World and Engineer. In it, he outlined his work to date and plans for the future, adorning the piece with breathtaking photographs of his transmission stations in Colorado Springs and Wardenclyffe. "The results attained by me have made my scheme of world telegraphy easily realizable. It constitutes a radical and fruitful departure from what has been done heretofore. It involves the employment of a number of plants, each of which will be preferably located near some important center of civilization, and the news it receives through any channel will be flashed to all points of the globe. A cheap and simple pocket-sized device may then be set up somewhere on sea or land, and it will record the world news or such special messages as may be intended for it. Thus, the entire Earth will be converted into a huge brain, as it were, capable of response in every one of its parts. Since a single plant of but 100 horsepower can operate hundreds of millions of instruments, the system will have a virtually infinite working capacity. The first of these central plants would have been already completed had it not been for unforeseen delays which, fortunately, have nothing to do with its purely technical features. This delay may prove, after all, to be blessing in disguise. For the work done so far, I am indebted to the noble generosity of Mr. J. Pierpont Morgan, which was all the more welcome as it was extended at a time when those who have since promised most were the greatest of doubters. I have also to thank my friend Stanford White, for much unselfish assistance. This work is now far advanced, and though the results may be tardy, they are sure to come." 35. Dissolution, 1904-1906. "I have observed in the House of Morgan a largeness, nobility, and firmness of character, the like of which is very scarce indeed. I can only smile when I read of the attempts to find something discreditable in the transactions of J.P. Morgan and Company. Not a hundred of such investigations will ever uncover anything which an unprejudiced judge would not consider honorable, fair, decent, and in every way conforming to the high ideals and ethical standards of business. I would be willing to stake my life on it." Nikola Tesla. Sociologist Karl Mannheim suggests that the psycho-historian should attempt to reconstruct both the subjects Weltanschauung and the spirit of the age in question. Irrational components should be recognized. Thus, and in this sense, history is paradoxical. It is contradictory, dynamic, multi-leveled, and dialectic. Tesla's worldview involved a philosophy based on the work of Wolfgang von Goethe. His inventions were for him not true creations in the sense that they stemmed from nothing. They evolved from the work of others and from uncovering secret mechanisms lying within hidden laws of nature. "Was it God who wrote each sign, which, all my inner tumult stilling, and this poor heart with rapture filling, reveals to me by a force divine, great nature's energies around and through me thrilling? Am I a god? It grows so bright to me, each character on which my eye reposes, nature in act before my soul discloses." This idea can clearly be found in Goethe's Faust, Tesla's favorite poem, which he memorized in its entirety, and which he referred to throughout his life. It was Faust which he recited in Budapest during his salad days, when he uncovered the secret to the rotating magnetic field, and it was a Faustian paradigm to which he adhered when he linked the invention of the world telegraphy system to the discovery of the Holy Grail. There manifests itself in the fully developed being, man, a desire mysterious, inscrutable, and irresistible, to imitate nature, to create, to work himself the wonders he perceives. He subdues and puts to his service the fierce, devastating spark of Prometheus, the titanic forces of the waterfall, the wind and the tide. He tames the thundering bolt of Jove and annihilates time and space. He makes the great sun itself his obedient, toiling slave. Can man control this grandest, most awe-inspiring of all processes in nature? Can he harness her inexhaustible energies to perform all their functions at his bidding? If he could do this, he would have powers almost unlimited and supernatural. This would be the supreme manifestation of the power of man's mind, his most complete triumph over the physical world, his crowning achievement, which would place him beside his Creator, make him fulfill his ultimate destiny. Nikola Tesla. Two major themes which run through Goethe's poem are that 1, secrets of nature can be revealed and harnessed to human needs, and that 2, humans are enticed by satanic forces. Clearly, Tesla was driven by both tenets. In the second case, consciously or unconsciously, Morgan was sought out for the very reason that he was a demigod, a superhuman whose life transcended that of mere mortals. Just as Faust was tempted by Mephistopheles, Tesla was lured by the House of Morgan. In the financier's strong hands, Tesla willingly, and alas irrationally, handed over the 51% control, insisting on it. Knowing that the contract involved relinquishing his cornucopia of past and future patent applications, the inventor still sealed the Faustian pact, as the terms were immaterial to him. Mephistopheles. Whatever promise on your books find entry, we strictly carry into act. For the present, I entreat most urgently your kind dismission. Faust. Do stay but just one moment longer, then. Tell me good news, and I'll release thee. Dear Mr. Morgan, since many years I have known one side of your character intimately. I believe that in my first approach to you, I have given you evidence of this knowledge. You have already put aside the money necessary to complete the work begun, in your thoughts, and that is as good as done. But I did not understand you as a businessman until lately. I have worked for results, carrying with them a dignity and force such as to deserve your attention. What you wanted was a simple result. Will you let me profit by this later knowledge and give me an opportunity to rehabilitate myself in your opinion as a businessman? In October 1903, fully 2 months before Orville and Wilbur Wright made aviation history, Professor Samuel P. Langley launched a heavier-than-air ship from the roof of a houseboat situated on the Potomac. With photographers from the Smithsonian Institution present, the craft was slingshot over the 70-foot rails and in a moment was free upon air. Then it wavered. Down the aerodrome sank, with its daring navigator emerging from the disaster, suffering only a ducking. The press called Langley's airplane a failure, but Tesla rallied to Langley's defense. "Langley has perceived a great truth," Tesla wrote in the New York Herald, "namely, that a machine heavier than air could be made to fly. Such a man should be provided with the necessary means to complete his work. Great honor attaches to this achievement, and also great practical utility, which this country can ill afford to lose." Tesla started off 1904 on the offensive, with his manifesto and striking publications. Work on the wireless operation was suspended, and essential components were stripped from the tower and returned to disgruntled creditors. A skeleton crew kept up appearances and continued the development of his lamps and oscillators. But as his Wardenclyffe notes reveal, there was no theoretical writings during this period. All of Tesla's energies were concentrated in one avenue, raising the funds to resurrect the project. Tesla's attorneys had located a manufacturer in Connecticut to make all the metal parts of his oscillators, but there was still the problem of distribution, and the revenues would not enable him to reopen the Wardenclyffe plant. Another predicament had to do with Mr. Warden himself. Apparently he had not conducted a title search when he purchased the land, and a legal shadow had fallen on the property. Tesla used the entanglement to further delay payment of the mortgage. One consideration, he wrote Scherf, is that the Edison-Pupin-Marconi combination, who have given me so much trouble, are in a worse fix. In February, Tesla attended a musical recital and party in Gramercy Park, hosted by Stanford White and his wife Bessie, for 350 of his friends, with dinner afterwards at Sherry's. Most likely, the inventor crossed paths with Morgan, as well as other potential investors. The following month, the inventor conferred with the CEO, Chief Executive Officer, of GE, Charles Coffin. If the GE people refuse, they are simply snoozers, he wrote Scherf. Nothing came of the meeting. But in April, a solid lead came via John S. Barnes, a well-connected financier who had read Tesla's article in Electrical World and Engineer. An associate of Colonel Oliver Payne's from the Rockefeller clique, Barnes had invited Tesla to his home for dinner and to discuss the inventor's plans. I have always had the highest regard for Colonel Payne, and would be happy indeed should he ever deem me worthy of his association. We are curious as to the details of the Commodore's bestowal, Barnes interjected. Mr. Morgan has not made a generous donation, as you might have inferred from my article, Tesla craftily retorted. He is a man with a great brain, and has seen that by forming a business partnership instead, he can make an extremely profitable investment. Although hesitant to make a commitment, Barnes nevertheless suggested that Tesla have his lawyers write up their evaluation of his patent applications. Because of his link to Colonel Payne, Tesla took the suggestion very seriously. A multimillionaire from the city of Cleveland, Payne had made his fortune as a partner of John D. Rockefeller. The duo had earned 50 cents per barrel for every barrel of oil that was shipped by rail. This enormous kickback had been set up as a rebate for their own crude and as a tariff for every competitor. With their vast holdings and Rockefeller's ferret-like spirit, they had simply bullied the railroads into this contractual arrangement. Known as a haughty fellow and kin of God, Payne never did take to John D., but he did maintain the partnership. He had a residence in New York and was a friend and financial benefactor of Stanford White, whom he commissioned to purchase art for him while in Europe and design his nephew's mansion, Payne Whitney, in the city. White, who was in an awful fix, nearly three-quarters of $1 million in debt, mainly from the Northern Pacific fiasco, informed Tesla that Payne had provided him with notable assistance to help ease his burden. White was also disheartened because his girlfriend, young Evelyn Nesbitt, had now begun dating a deranged multimillionaire from Pittsburgh, Harry Thor. I have heard stories from the Floridora girls that he whipped one of them in bed with a cat of nine tails. Ironically, White held no ill feelings for Morgan, even though the financier was directly responsible for the market crash. At the close of 1903, White and his wife Bessie joined the Commodore on the Corsair to watch the yacht races, and White's partner, Charles McKim, was still busily involved in constructing the Morgan Library. One wonders how Morgan might have felt when he boated up to Newport or Bar Harbor and looked to the eastern horizon and saw Tesla's mushroom-shaped behemoth. Do you think he will ever reconsider? The inventor inquired. With Morgan, anything is possible, came the architect's reply. However, I think at this stage, Colonel Payne is a safer bet. A Yankee cornerstone, the good colonel was connected to the highest echelons in government. Through the marriage of his sister, he was linked to William C. Whitney, Secretary of the Navy, and also to John Hay, Secretary of State. Payne's father, Henry Payne, was a well-known senator, often discussed as a potential candidate for the President of the United States. This was not a lead to take lightly. As a favor to this Ohio nobleman, Tesla opened up his storehouse to the Cleveland leader and conferred with Kerr, Page, and Cooper for a way to create a legal document that would delineate the scope and fundamental might of his arsenal of patents. In a comprehensive article entitled Harnessing the Lightning, journalist Alfred Cowles noted that the inventor's prognostications were so startling that had they come from another source, one would naturally consider them the vagaries of a wandering mind. If he can accomplish what he is undertaking, his fame will, in future centuries, overshadow the greatest names of the past. Echoing sentiments Tesla had expressed during their interview, Cowles concluded, "Real inventions are only possible when the mental creation of the inventor proves to be in harmony with natural law, and such inventions, when they are necessities, are in themselves a part of the evolutionary process, where development is an adjustment to environment. How all one whole harmonious weaves, each in the other works and lives. I see heavenly powers ascending and descending, the golden buckets one long line extending. Tesla presented to Barnes and Payne a comprehensive lawyer's brief, delineating essentially every feature of his master plan. Included were patent specifications and plans for distributing electrical energy without wires for telegraphic, telephonic, and industrial purposes, for storing the energy, localizing transmissions, ensuring non-interferability, and for creating separate channels. Also included was Tesla's work in teleautomatics, means for creating high frequencies, his oscillators, and a method for insulating electric mains by refrigeration to very low temperature. By this means, power can be conveyed to great distances cheaply and literally without any loss. The plan also suggested the perfect solution of the problem of underground distribution in cities and populated districts. Thus, the ultimate scheme would involve both wireless and conventional means of distributing the electrical energy. Analyzing the viability of each of the 23 patents, lawyers Kerr, Page, and Cooper concluded, "We know of nothing to anticipate the claims, and are of the opinion that they are valid." The report was also circulated to other major players, including Fortune Ryan and Pierpont Morgan. "I swear," Tesla wrote to Scherf, "if I ever get out of this hole, nobody will catch me without cash." Simultaneously, he haggled with the coal company to maintain fuel deliveries and with the telephone company to keep his line at Wardenclyffe open. "I am now sure that the two lamps as proposed will be a perfect success, and you know that after that I can draw on the U.S. Treasury." Problems with the lamp persisted, however, and it would never be marketed under Tesla's name. October the 28th, 1958. Westinghouse announcement. Lamp Division. The Westinghouse Corporation is pleased to announce that a flat light bulb, which has no filaments, which produces no heat, which is glare-free, and which will burn night and day for a year for less than a penny, has been introduced. This marks the first time the public has been able to purchase an electroluminescent lamp as a light source for the home. As the Colonel Payne deal fell through, Tesla wrote to Morgan from Wardenclyffe, "I hope the unfortunate misunderstanding, the cause of which I have been vainly trying to discover, will be removed, and that you will recognize that my work is the kind that passes into history and worthy of your support." Throughout the spring and summer, Tesla would visit the plant again and again for strength and confirmation. In June, he instructed Scherf to make sure that the lawn was manicured at Wardenclyffe, as he was arriving with another potential investor. Yet his resolve was beginning to waver. Everywhere he turned, he met rejection. He became convinced that his success rested on changing the mind of a single man. In September, a dispatch was hand-delivered to Morgan, assuring contracts for several such plants in England and Russia. But no response came from the financier. During the height of autumn, Morgan conferred with the Archbishop of Canterbury. Taking this as a mystical sign in the aid of his quest, the engineering Connoscenti authored on October the 13th, his favorite day of the month, a 13-point letter spelling out the entire chain of events to the omnipotent capitalist. The letter began with a discussion of his patent applications, the development of their liaison, and Tesla's decision to change the nature of the agreement because of Marconi's piracy. Simply transmitting mere Morse-coded messages was beneath consideration for the pompous conceptualist. As he had aligned himself with the greatest economic force on the planet, this confirmed the necessity of engaging in the larger endeavor. "Your participation called for a careful revision of my plans. Perhaps you have never fully appreciated the sense of this obligation. Once I lost your support, I could not, because of your personality and character of our agreement, interest anybody else, at least not for several years, until the commercial value of my patents was recognized. By increasing the size of the transmitter, until the plant can transmit signals to the uttermost confines of the earth, Its earning power becomes, so to speak, unlimited, but it will cost scarcely twice as much, e.g. $300,000. This offered possibilities for a business on a large, dignified scale, commensurate with your position in life and mine as pioneer in this art, who has originated all its essential principles. You had told me from the outset that I should not ask for more, but the work was of such transcending importance that I undertook to explain to you the state of things on your first return from abroad. You seem to misunderstand me. This was most unfortunate. The audacious schemers who have dared to fool the crowned heads of Europe, the President of the United States, and even His Holiness the Pope, have discredited the art by incompetent attempts, far more than they ever could by success, and spoiled the public by false promises which it cannot distinguish from legitimate right and skill. Now, I know you must be skeptical about getting hundredfold returns, but if you will help me to the end, you will soon see that my judgment is true. I have expended about $250,000 in all, and a much smaller sum separates me from a giant triumph. $75,000 would certainly complete the plant. This letter, greatly condensed here, was a fair and accurate assessment of what had occurred and why. Clearly, it was written by a lucid savant, one who had proved himself in industry on many other occasions, and one who was on the verge of altering the course of civilization in a dramatic and revolutionary way. Tesla was operating at the level of soul consciousness, and so he removed all defenses and revealed the very depths of his being with the following salutation and sacred vow. Since a year, Mr. Morgan, there has been hardly a night when my pillow is not bathed in tears, but you must not think me a weak man for that. I am perfectly sure to finish my task, come what may. I am only sorry that after mastering all the difficulties which seemed insuperable, and acquiring a special knowledge and ability which I now alone possess, and which, if applied effectively, would advance the world a century, I must see my work delayed. In hope of hearing from you favorably, I remain N. Tesla. October 15th, 1904. Dear Sir, referring to your letter of the 13th of October, Mr. J.P. Morgan wishes me to inform you that it will be impossible for him to do anything more in the matter. This cavalier dismissal tore the inventor apart and opened up a tendril that bared not only his wrath against the force that had blocked his crusade, but also a poetic eloquence. October 17th, 1904. Dear Mr. Morgan, you are a man like Bismarck, great but uncontrollable. I wrote purposefully last week, hoping that your recent association with the Archbishop might have rendered you more susceptible to a softer influence. But you are no Christian at all. You are a fanatic Mussulman. Once you say no, come what may, it is no. May the gravitation repel instead of attract, may right become wrong. Every consideration, no matter what it may be, must founder on the rock of your brutal resolve. It is incredible. A year and a half ago, I could have delivered a lecture here which would have been listened to by all of the academicians of the world. That would have been the time to thank you. But you let me struggle on, weakened by shrewd enemies, disheartened by doubting friends, financially exhausted, trying to overcome obstacles which you yourself have piled up before me. If this is a good thing, why does not Morgan see you through? Morgan is the very last man to let a good thing go. So it has been going on for 2 years. I advance, but how? Like a man swimming against a stream that carries him down. Will you not listen to anything at all? Are you to let me perhaps succumb, lose an immortal crown? Will you let a property of immense value be depreciated? Let it be said that your own judgment was defective simply because you once said no. Can now I make you a new proposition to overcome the difficulty? I tell you, I shall return your money 100-fold. The letter was followed up with testimonials to his abilities as espoused by various leaders in his field. It also explained in detail how this operation advanced the work performed at Colorado Springs. On December the 16th, Tesla sent an ultimatum. He requested either $100,000 to complete the plant or $50,000 to finish the indispensable parts, make everything perfectly fireproof, and take out insurance. Or, if you do not want this, only one thing remains. You release me of all obligations. Give me back my assignments and consider the sum you have invested as a generous contribution, leaving it all to my integrity and ability to work out the best results for you and for myself. Tesla suggested that he could go on a lecture tour to raise the funds. Then it would take him not more than a week to get a few million in Wall Street. On the 17th, Morgan wrote back, "I am not willing to advance you any more money, as I have frequently told you. As to your third proposition, I am not prepared to accept this either. I have made and carried out with you in good faith a contract, and having performed my part, it is not unreasonable that I expect you to carry out yours." December 19th, 1904. Dear Mr. Morgan, owing to a habit contracted long ago in defiance of superstition, I prefer to make important communications on Fridays and the 13th of each month. But my house is afire, and I have not an hour to waste. I knew that you would refuse. What chance have I to land the biggest Wall Street monster with the soul's spicier thread? You say that you have fulfilled your contract with me. You have not. I came to enlist your genius and power not because of money. You should know that I have honored you in so doing as much as I have honored myself. You are a big man, but your work is wrought in passing form. Mine is immortal. I came to you with the greatest invention of all times. I have more creations named after me than any man that has gone before, not excepting Archimedes and Galileo, the giants of invention. $6,000,000,000 are invested in enterprises based on my discoveries in the United States today. This is not a boast, Mr. Morgan. Only my credentials. I could draw on you at sight for $1,000,000 if you were the Pierpont Morgan of old. At this point, Tesla refers to what he perceives as Morgan's breach of contract. When we entered our contract, I furnished 1. Patent rights. 2. My ability as an engineer and electrician. 3. My goodwill. You were to furnish 1. Money. 2. Your business ability. 3. Your goodwill. I assigned patent rights, which in the worst case are worth 10 times your cash investment. You advanced the money, true, but even this first clause of our contract was violated. There was a delay of 2 months in furnishing the last $50,000, a delay which was fatal. I complied conscientiously with the second and third obligations. You ignored yours deliberately. Not only this, but you discredited me. There is only one way to go, Mr. Morgan. Give me the money to finish a great work, or else make me a present and let me work out my salvation. Your interest is sacred to me, and my hearty wishes for your happiness and welfare will always be with you. Faithfully yours, N. Tesla. To demonstrate goodwill, Tesla enclosed a royalty check on one of his patents and an advance copy of his theoretical masterpiece, the transmission of electrical energy without wires as a means of furthering peace. A fortnight later, on January the 6th, 1905, Morgan sent the 49% balance legally due the inventor. The Wardenclyffe Peace Plan. Published in Electrical World and Engineer, Tesla's treatise ran nearly 6,000 words. It began with a discussion of how philanthropy and the practical utilization of electrical vibrations, that is, a mass communication system, might bring about universal peace. In defining and analyzing this theme, Tesla noted that it may come about suddenly as the result of a slow accumulation of past efforts through history. We must think cosmically. The race enmities and prejudices are decidedly waning. So far, however, universal harmony has been attained only in a single sphere of international relationship, that is, the postal service. A few strong countries might scare all the weaker ones into peace, Tesla suggests, but to conquer by sheer force is becoming harder and harder every day. just as cruise missiles, CNN and the world news organizations have altered markedly the way war is conducted today by having machines